Back home in Texas, I was 19 years old, had a year in Australia under my belt, and was now drinking age. On the way home from buying dog food and paper towels at Walmart one night, Dad and I stopped by a neon-lit pool hall in a strip mall on the southwest side of Houston. We had a few beers, I met a few of his friends, mostly kept to my yes and no sirs, but had enough confidence and experience to chime in to some of the tall tale-telling. A couple of hours later, we paid the tab at the bar and started to leave. As I stepped out of the entrance door, my dad behind me, the big bicep bouncer who was standing just outside stepped in front of my dad and said, "You pay your bill?" Without slowing his pace, Dad said, "Sure did, pal," and continued walking. That's when the man at the door did something that my mind's eye can still see in slow motion today. In an attempt to slow my dad's passage, he put his hand on my dad's chest. Another man's hand on my dad. Before Dad could correct this wannabe muscle man with his own hands, I did with mine. The next thing I remember, I was on top of this bouncer who was now splayed across the table 15 feet back inside the bar. I pounded down on him with vicious right fist until the drunken jeers of a good bar fight slowly turned to murmurs. The fight was over. It had been over, but not for me. Then I felt myself being pulled off the man and held back. I continued to kick and spit at the doorman on the floor until I heard a strong, calming voice in my ear. "That's enough, son. That's enough." That night was my rite of passage. Dad let me in. It was the night I became his boy, a man in his eyes. The night we became friends. The night he called every one of his buddies who knew me and said, "The youngest one's going to be okay, boys. Oh, you should have seen him take this big old boy out last night at the bar. Just decked him. We got to keep an eye on him, though. He's got a berserker switch in him. He's a little bit crazy." From that night on, I could go to the bar with him, my brother, Mike, and all the men I'd been calling Mr. all my life. It was a primitive initiation into my father's regard, but finally, instead of only hearing about the stories from last night the next day, I could be a part of them. Green light. Note to self. Sometimes we find our frequency by holding on to a moral bottom line in the midst of chaos. Sometimes we find it by breaking the rules and running the red light to get our ass home. I came across this journal passage that I wrote in May of 1989 while in Australia. At the top, I have a sticky note. It says, "Style is knowing who you are, what you want to say, and not giving a damn." It's by Gore Vidal. Under it, I wrote, "Isn't that the fucking truth? To have style, you have to have these in this order. You've got to know who you are before you know what you want to say, then not give a damn. But knowing who you are is the base that everything else comes from. I've got more style now than ever before, but I'm still adding to my style. You know who you are when you become independent enough to believe your own thoughts and become responsible for your actions, and you not only believe what you want, but you live what you believe." Then in all caps, I wrote, "Live what you believe. Live the questions first, then what you believe. Then you have your own personal style." I signed it off. It said, MDM. That was fun to write. Part 3, Dirt Roads and Autobahns. July 1989. While in Australia, I had begun applying to colleges. Duke, Grambling, UT Austin, and Southern Methodist. I wanted to study law and become a defense attorney. That had been the plan since ninth grade. I was a great debater, and the somewhat serious joke of my household was that Matthew's going to become our lawyer, defend the family business, prosecute some bigwigs, make us some Orla Mink money. I was set on SMU, largely because it was in the metropolitan city of Dallas, and I believed Dallas would have more opportunities for me to intern in a law firm, which would then give me a better chance of having a job as soon as I graduated. One night, Dad called me. "Son, are you sure you don't want to be a Longhorn?" My dad's always named a school after its mascot and was particularly fond of UTs. "No, Dad, I want to be a Mustang." That's SMU's mascot. "I'm pretty sure about it," he grumbled. "Is that all right with you, Dad?" "Oh, yeah, sure, son. Just Thought you might want to consider being a Longhorn is all. Well, no, sir, Pop. I want to be a Mustang. Okay, that'll work, he said, and we hung up. An hour later, my brother Pat called. What's up, I asked. Hey, bud, you sure you don't want to be a Longhorn, little brother? Yeah, big brother. You sure? Yeah, I'm sure. Well, why do you and Dad keep asking me that? Well, listen here. Dad won't ever tell you, but the oil business is in bad shape. I mean, he's broke, trying to keep from going Chapter 11, and that's bankruptcy. He is? Yeah. And it'll cost him $18,000 a year for you to go to SMU because it's private, but only $5,000 a year to go to UT because it's public. Oh, shit, I said. I had no idea. Yeah. And hey, little brother, you ever been to Austin, man? No? Ah, you're going to love it, buddy. It's your kind of town. You can walk into anywhere in your flip-flops, have a seat at a bar, and you'll have a cowboy to the right of you, a lesbian to your left, an Indian on the other side, and a midget-tending bar. All you got to be is yourself in that town. I called Dad back the next day. Pop, I changed my mind. I want to be a Longhorn. Oh, you do? He said, not masking his excitement. Yes, sir. Oh, God damn you, little buddy. Great choice. What made you change your mind? Oh, I don't know, Pop. I just like Longhorns better than Mustangs. Out of respect for my dad, I attended the University of Texas at Austin, but never told him why. I knew changing my mind would make Dad happy. I'd soon change it again, but this time I wasn't so sure of his reaction. Note to self. When we know what we want to do, knowing when to do it is the hard part. Get them early so you don't have to get them as often. Prevent before the cure. Habilitate before the re. It was the end of my sophomore year in college. Final exams were looming, and I wasn't sleeping well. Not because of my mattress, because of my mind. I was having doubts about my plans to become a lawyer. The math didn't add up. 4 years of undergrad, and I'd be 23. Then 3 more years of law school, and I'd be 26 before I'd get out, get a job. I wouldn't start making my mark in this world until I was almost 30 years old. I didn't want to miss my 20s preparing for the rest of my life. I'd also been writing short stories in my journal. I passed a few off to my good friend Rob Bendler, a film student at NYU, who attested they were original and worth sharing. You thought about film school? He asked. You're a good storyteller. Film school? Wow. That sounded so flattering, but it also sounded so foreign, almost European, radical, irresponsible, indulgent, so artsy. I couldn't even get the idea into the dialect of my dreams, much less considered as a rational aspiration. Nah, not for me. A few hours before my psychology final exam, I showed up at my fraternity, grabbed lunch, and went across the back alley to a couple of fellow Delt brothers' place so I could finish studying. They were both sleeping in bunk beds because they'd pulled all-nighters cramming. I sat on their couch and opened my textbook. I was a diligent studier. I would use every spare second I had to prepare for a test and took great pride in being composed and ready for any exam. I made a lot of A's. But on this day, for some reason, with the exam only a few hours away, I said to myself, "You've got this, McConaughey," and put the textbook and my notes back in my backpack and turned on the TV. ESPN. Now look, I love sports. I will watch the World's Strongest Man competition if that's all it's on. Today, it was a baseball game. Even better. But after about 5 minutes, for some reason, I shut the TV off. Not interested. I looked around the room. On the floor to the left of me was a stack of magazines. Playboys. Hustlers. Now, I love women, and I love looking at naked women. But for some reason, not today. Not interested. As I flipped about 7 mags deep into the pile, I came across a small paperback book. It had a white cover with a handsome red cursive-like title that read, "The Greatest Salesman in the World." Well, who's that? I wondered as I picked it up from the pile and began to read. 2.5 hours later, I got to the first scroll in the book. The book had just revealed that the title was referring to the reader of the book, me in this instance. And now my instructions were to read each scroll 3 times a day for 30 days before moving on to the next one. I looked at my watch. My exam was in 20 minutes. I rustled my friend from his bunk. "Can I borrow this book, Braden?" I asked.
"No, man. You can have it,"
I left, book in hand, and made it to my test on time. I was high. Something about this book, the title, the story so far, the mystery of the Ten Scrolls, felt special. Like it had found me. I rushed through my exam. I didn't care about psychology class, and I didn't care what grade I made. I only cared about reading that first scroll. Somehow, I knew that something bigger than a classroom exam lay within the pages of this book. Scroll 1. I will form good habits and become their slave. It occurred to me that it was a bad habit to lie to myself any longer. Becoming a lawyer wasn't for me. I wanted to tell stories. I paced my dorm room trying to assess the best time to call my dad and tell him I had changed my mind and no longer wanted to go to law school. I wanted to go to film school. At 7:30, I thought, he would have just had dinner and would be relaxing on the couch with his first cocktail, catching some tube with mom. Yeah, 7:30 was the right time to call. My dad taught us to do a job well and climb the 9-to-5 company ladder. I had been groomed to be the family's lawyer. We were a blue-collar family. Film school? Oh, shit. Taking deep breaths, sweating, I made the call at 7:36 p.m. Dad answered. Hey, Pop, I said.
Hey, little buddy, what's going on? He asked.
Well, I want to share something with you.
What's that?
Oh, shit. Well, I don't want to go to law school anymore. I want to go to film school. Silence. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds. Then I heard a voice, a kind, inquisitive voice.
Is that what you want to do? He asked.
Yes, sir, Dad, it is. Silence. Another 5 seconds.
Well, don't half-ass it.
Of all the things my dad could have said, of all the reactions he could have had, don't half-ass it were the last words I expected to hear and the best words he could have ever said to me. With those words, he not only gave me his blessing and consent, he gave me his approval and validation. It's what he said and how he said it. He not only gave me privilege, he gave me honor, freedom, and responsibility. With some formidable rocket fuel in his delivery, we made a pact that day. Thanks, Pop. Green light.
Note to self, biology and giddy up, DNA and work, genetics and willpower, life's a combination. Some get the genes, but never the work ethic or the resilience. Others work their ass off, but never had the innate ability. Others have both and never rely on the first.
I didn't have a short film or a piece of art to audition for film school. But I did have a 3.82 GPA. Not only did it get me into film school, it got me into the honors program. But now I was pursuing a career path where, unlike law, my GPA did not matter. I knew Hollywood and artists didn't care if I made A's or F's. They needed to see something worthy of their attention. I needed to make something, a film, a performance. I needed a job. I signed with the local Donna Adams talent agency and started interning at an ad agency 4 days a week between classes. I wore a pager on my hip and would step out of class without hesitation to drive to San Antonio or Dallas to audition for a music video or a beer ad. I got a bunch of no thank yous. The first gig I landed was as a hand model. Donna Adams had told me upon signing that I had good-looking hands, and if I quit biting my nails, I might have a future in the hand modeling business. She was correct. I've never bit my nails since. Good looks don't cook the dinner, but they'll get you a seat at the table, and I was determined to take advantage of any seat I could get. I directed short films in black and white on 16mm Bolex cameras. I edited. I assistant directed other classmates' films. I directed photography. I wrote and performed. I missed a lot of classes driving to San Antonio and Dallas. One day, the dean called me into his office.
Matthew, attendance is mandatory in our classes, especially the honors program. You cannot keep missing class or leaving in the middle of class as you have been. If you continue to do so, I will have to fail you.
Dean, I said, looking him directly in the eye,
You and I both know that a degree in film production doesn't mean squat to studio heads in Hollywood and New York City. It means nothing to the people that make movies. They want to see a product, a film, a performance, something. The only reason I'm skipping class is to go out into the real world and try and make something that those people will want to purchase. I'm chasing things outside of the classroom that the classroom is teaching me to chase. Then I had an idea, and I blurted it out. Look, if I promise to make it to every exam day in class, will you just give me C's across the board? He didn't answer. Nonetheless, I stuck to my proposal. I kept skipping classes to chase my pager, and I made sure I showed up as prepared as possible on exam days. At the end of the semester, I received a C in every class on my college transcript. But I learned a whole lot more than when I was making A's. Green light.
Bumper sticker. I'll take a little common sense with that knowledge.
I was an outcast in class anyway. The only frat guy in film school. Boots, press button down, tucked in, tan, affable, non-neurotic. Most everyone else wore black. They were pale, goth, and huddled into their private corners. One of our professors made us go see movies each weekend and come back on Monday and talk about them with the class. I would always go to the Metroplex and see the blockbuster, then come in on Monday and say, "Hey, I saw Die Hard this weekend," and dot. "Nah, that's shit, man. That's shit. That stuff sucks," my classmates would say before I could finish my sentence. They had all gone to see the Eisenstein retrospective. I began to doubt myself. This is what you have to do to be an artist, McConaughey. You have to see the art films at the art house, not the blockbusters at the Metroplex. You aren't independent enough, McConaughey. You need to be more eccentric, less friendly. I started untucking my shirt. But I still went to see the blockbusters. The next Monday, I got in front of the class to talk about what I'd seen. And again, the rest of the students started murmuring, "Ah, that's big studio shit, man. Corporate America sellouts." This time I said, "Well, wait a minute. Tell me why it's shit. Tell me why it sucks. What you didn't like about it." They all got quiet. Heads started looking back and forth to each other. Finally, one of them said, "Well, I mean, look, we didn't actually see it. We just know it's shit." "Fuck y'all," I said. "Fuck y'all for saying something is shit just because it's popular." After that day, I was comfortable being both in the fraternity and a film student. I tucked my shirt back in.
Prescription. Tribes. We want lovers, friends, recruits, soldiers, and affiliations that support who we are. People, individuals, believe in themselves, want to survive, and on a Darwinistic level, at least, want to have more of ourselves. Initially, this is a visual choice, the where, what, when, and who to our why. Upon closer inspection, which is the upfall of the politically correct culture of today, we learn to measure people on the competence of their values that we most value. When we do this, the politics of gender, race, and slanderous slang take a back seat to the importance of the values we share. The more we travel, the more we realize how similar our human needs are. We want to be loved, have a family, community, have something to look forward to. These basic needs are present in all socioeconomic and cultural civilizations. I myself have seen many tribes in the deserts of northern Africa who, with 9 children and no electricity, had more joy, love, honor, and laughter than the majority of the most materially rich people I've ever met. We have the choice to love, befriend, recruit, call to arms, associate, and support who we believe in, and more importantly, who we believes in us. I think that's what we all want, to believe in and be believed in. We all must earn belief in ourselves first, then for each other. Earn it with you, then earn it with me. Then we earn it for we. Travel and humanity have been my greatest educators. They have helped me understand the common denominator of mankind. Values. Engage with yourself, then engage with the world. Values travel, and sometimes we get a stamp in our passport just by crossing the street.
Fascinated with the differences between people and cultures, I've always enjoyed looking for and finding the common denominator of values that are the foundation beneath our distinctions. When my college buddies and I would hit Sixth Street for a night out, they'd go to the popular bars littered with sorority girl possibilities, and I'd go to Catfish Station, an all-black sweaty bar that sold catfish, beer, and blues. It was standing room only when Kyle Turner was on his saxophone or the all-blind band Blue Mist were on the stage. I'd find my spot stage left by the beer cooler. I'd lean against it, serve myself, and let the cool air keep my perspiration from dripping. Larone managed the joint. Tammy was the black and beautiful as midnight rock star waitress who ran the floor and had every single dude in the joint thinking they had a chance, just so they'd tip more. None of them did. Have a chance, that is. Me included. But we tipped a little extra anyway. One night around closing time, while paying Larone for the 6 bottles of beer I'd drunk, I told him I wanted a job waiting tables. The hand modeling gigs were sparse, and I needed some extra spending money. And besides, I liked the blues. Larone laughed. I was the only white person, male or female, who was ever in this place. I'm serious, Larone. I need the cash, and I like the music in here, I said. He laughed again, then stared at me a minute. "Aye, crazy motherfucker," he said, pulling out a pen and writing on a receipt. "Go to this address, Tuesday morning at 9, and ask for Homer. He's the owner. I'll let him know you're coming." I showed up at the appointed time. The place was also on 6th Street, but in a much bigger open-floored club. Business at Catfish Station was good, and the joint would soon be moving to a larger venue. This one. In the middle of the room stood a black man, well over 340 pounds, wearing an all-white janitor's uniform and dripping sweat on the concrete floor he was mopping. Another black man was standing at the bar, back to the entrance, doing paperwork. Homer? I asked aloud. The man at the bar didn't move. The other guy kept mopping. Homer Hill, I said a bit louder. The man at the bar turned his head over his right shoulder like he'd been interrupted. Yeah, that's me. I'm Matthew. Larone told me to come by here and see you. I want to be a waiter at Catfish Station. Over his shoulder, he said, Oh, yeah, that's right. Grab a mop and go with Carl to clean the men's room. Carl turned with his mop and began rolling his water bucket back towards the bathrooms. Never turning back, he pointed at another mop and bucket against the back wall. Not what I was expecting. I smiled. Homer did not. So I stepped to it, went to the men's room, and started mopping the floors like I was trying to take Carl's job. 10 to 15 minutes passed, head down, cleaning a stall. I heard, Man, put that mop down. I turned, and there was Homer. You really want a job waiting tables? Yeah, I do, I said. Homer shook his head a bit and let out a breathy giggle. All right, show up at the station Thursday night at 6. You can shadow Tammy and learn the ropes. On Thursday night, I showed up at Catfish Station at 5:45. I knew Tammy from the many nights I'd been a customer, but now I was there to learn from her, and she was not too happy about it. Tammy was the queen bee. She ran the entire floor, and now I was trespassing on her territory and her tips. But for the next 3 nights, Tammy initiated me. Where to clock in for work, how to run the register, how to place orders with the cooks, what to tip them at the end of the night, which tables would soon be mine, and which high-tipping customers I best not even look at. The next Thursday night, I started waiting tables for real. Game on. The clientele was 90% black men, 10% black women with those black men. 80% of those black men were single, and as much as they liked the blues, they came to the station for Tammy. And they weren't delighted to be waited on by a young, white man. And their tips told me as much. At the end of night one, I had cleared $32. Tammy made $98. I waited tables at Catfish Station Thursday through Saturday for the next 2 years. Many of those black men became my friends and even came to choose my section. Many, not most. Tammy and I became pretty close, but like every other straight man in the station, she never let me get so much as a peck on the cheek. I never stopped trying. I never beat her in tips either. Homer and I have maintained a friendship through the years. We actually went to a Longhorn game together last season. Green light.
Note to self, we are not here to tolerate our differences. We are here to accept them. We are not here to celebrate our sameness. We are here to salute our distinctions. We are not born into equal circumstances or with equal abilities, but we should have equal opportunity. As individuals, we unite in our values. Celebrate that. I had a little cash in my pocket from my job at Catfish Station, but not so much that I didn't appreciate a free drink. I picked up my girlfriend, Antonia, and took her to the bar at the top of the Hyatt where my classmate, Sam, was bartending, hence the free drinks. Two vodka and tonic, Sam. He brought them over and said, "Hey, there's a guy at the end of the bar who's in town producing a movie. He's been coming in here nightly. Let me introduce you to him." This is when I met the one and only Don Phillips. I welcomed him to Austin. We were both golfers and had played some of the same courses. He drank vodka and tonics as well. Many of them. A few hours later, as Don stood atop a chair in the midst of delivering one of his legendary loud charades of a story, the management, to no avail, tried to calm him down. When it was obvious Don wanted nothing to do with toning anything down, they tried to kick him out of the bar. Matching him drink for drink, I had no interest in Don calming down either, so we were unpeacefully escorted out of the Hyatt. Now past 2 a.m, as he rode with me in the cab to drop me off at my apartment, I pulled out a joint and we smoked it. "You ever done any acting, Matthew?" he asked. I told him I'd been in a Miller Lite commercial for about a second and a half and had done a music video for Trisha Yearwood. "Well, there's a small part in this movie I'm casting you might be right for. Come to this address tomorrow morning at 9:30 and pick up the script. I'll have the 3 scenes marked." The cabbie dropped me off at my apartment and Don and I said our goodnights. The next morning at 9:30, really the same morning, just 6 hours later, I arrived at the location Don had given me, and there was a script with my name on it and a handwritten note from Don that read, "Here's the script. The character's name is Wooderson. I'll get you in for an audition in 2 weeks. Over the years, I've come to call the kind of line in the script that can send me flying a launchpad line. This script was for Dazed and Confused. The line that sent me into flight was, "That's what I love about those high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age." Wooderson was 22 years old, but still hanging out around the high school. That line opened up an entire world into who he was, an encyclopedia into his psyche and spirit. I thought about my brother Pat when he was a senior and I was 11. He was my big brother, my hero. One day, Pat's Z28 was in the shop, so Mom and I were picking him up from high school. We were slowly pulling through campus in our 77 wood panel station wagon, Mom driving, me peering out the window in the back seat. Pat was not where we had planned to meet him. "Where is he?" asked Mom. Turning my head to look left and right and then out the back window, I saw him about 100 yards behind us, leaning against the brick wall in the shade of the school's smoking section, one knee bent, boot sole against the side of the building, pulling on a Marlboro, cooler than James Dean and 2 feet taller. "There he—" I started to shriek, then caught my tongue because I realized he'd get in trouble for smoking. "What's that?" Mom asked. "Oh, nothing, Mom, nothing." That image of my big brother, leaning against that wall, casually smoking that cigarette in his low-elbow, loose-wristed, lazy-fingered way, through my romantic 11-year-old little brother eyes, was the epitome of cool. He was literally 10 feet tall. It left an engraved impression in my heart and mind. And 11 years later, Wooderson was born from that impression. Note to self, cool. Cool is a natural law. If it was cool for that time, then it is cool for all time. A fad is just a branch on cool's trunk, a fashionable fling whose 15 minutes can never abide, no matter how long she trends to try. Cool stands the test of time, because cool never tries. Cool just is. I had 10 days to prepare for the audition, and I knew my man. But being that this was technically a job interview, I made sure to shave and tuck in my best long-sleeve button-down. When I got there and met the director, Richard Linklater, he soon said, "You're not really this guy, are you?" "No," I said, "but I know who he is." Then I leaned back,
lowered my eyelids, held my cigarette between the peace sign, and gave him my Wooderson. I got the job. He told me not to shave. Production was already in full swing. Soon, I got called to set to do a makeup and wardrobe test, meaning I would go through makeup and hair in the trailer that was already on set for the working actors. Then I would get into my selected wardrobe. Then Rick would come by during a break from shooting to approve or make comments on my overall look. They were shooting at the Top Notch Hamburger Drive-In that night. I remember stepping out of the makeup trailer in full wardrobe onto the sidewalk off Burnett Road in North Austin, about 30 yards from set. Rick came over. On approach, he began to smile widely as he took me in. He spread his arms in his open palm way as he looked me up and down. Peach pants, the nudge t-shirt, the comb over, the stash. Is that a Black Panther tattoo on your forearm? Yeah, man. What do you think? I said. I dig it. This is great. This is Wooderson. Now remember, I was not there to act that night. Wooderson was not in any of the scenes that were being shot. I was only there for Rick to approve my hair, makeup, and wardrobe. That's when Rick got an idea, and we began to do something that to this day we still do, which is play a game of verbal ping pong. I know Wooderson has probably been with the typical hot high school chicks, he said. Cheerleaders, majorettes, girls like that. But you think he'd have any interest in the redheaded intellectual? Well, sure, man. Wooderson likes all kinds of chicks, I said. Yeah, right? You know, Marissa Ribisi is playing Cynthia, the redheaded intellectual girl, and she's over here at the drive-in with her nerdy friends in the back seat. I mean, you think Wooderson might pull up and try and pick her up? Give me 30 minutes, I said. I took a walk with myself. Who's my man? I asked myself. Who's my man? What's going on tonight in this scene? It's their last day of school. Everyone's looking for a party. I know some Spanish. Next thing I know, I'm in my car. Well, Wooderson's car. On set, mic'd up. So, on action, you just pull up next to her like Wooderson would and try and pick her up, Rick instructed. Cool. Got it. Now, there were no lines written, and this was my first time on a film set. I'd never done this before. Anxious, I started going back over in my head who my man is. Who's my man? Who's Wooderson? What do I love? What do I love? I love my car. Well, I'm in my 70 Chevelle. That's one. I love getting high. Well, Slater's riding shotgun, and he's always got a doobie rolled up. That's two. I love rock and roll. Well, I've got Nugent Stranglehold in the 8-track. That's three. And that's when I heard action. I looked up across the parking lot at Cynthia, the redheaded intellectual, and said to myself, and I love chicks. As I put the car in drive and slowly pulled out, I thought to myself, well, I've got three out of four, and I'm headed to get the fourth, then said aloud, all right, all right, all right. Those three words, those three affirmations of what I, Wooderson, did have were the first three words I ever said on film. A film that my character only had three scripted scenes in. A film that I ended up working on for 3 weeks. Now, 28 years later, those words follow me everywhere. People say them, people steal them, people wear them on their hats and t-shirts. People have them tattooed on their arms and inner thighs. And I love it. It's an honor, because those three words are the very first words I said on the very first night of a job I had that I thought might be nothing but a hobby, but turned into a career. Green light.
Note to self, one in a row. Any success takes one in a row. Do one thing well, then another. Once, then once more. Over and over until the end. Then it's one in a row again.
5 days into shooting, I got a call from my mom at about 7 o'clock in the evening. I was in the kitchen. Your dad died. My knees buckled. I couldn't believe it. My dad was the abominable snowman, the immovable force, a bear of a man with the immune system of a Viking and the strength of a bull. Impossible. He was my dad. Nobody or no thing could kill him. Except Mom. He'd always told me and my brothers, "Boys, when I go, I'm going to be making love to your mother." And that's what happened. When he woke up that morning at 6:30, feeling frisky, he made love to the woman he had divorced twice and married three times, his wife, Kay, my mom. He had a heart attack when he climaxed. Yep, he called his shot all right.
Note to self, days of prosperity. Days of prosperity make us forget adversity. Good times seem out of reach during the bad ones. Both can seem like final destinations, the summation of our days. Then the cosmic joker plays with our ways. Yesterday's condition no longer remains. All commas, no periods, all stops, no stays. The pleasure's for rent, and so is the pain.
I drove home to Houston that night. We had an Irish wake 2 days later where hundreds of friends gathered and told stories about him, just the way he'd instructed us to do when he talked about his passing. Losing my father, like it is for many, was my most seminal rite of passage into manhood. No more safety net. No one above the law and government looking after me anymore. It was time for me to grow up. Time to say goodbye to the boy I'd been, building tree houses in the middle of the night. A realization came to me. I carved these words into a tree. Less impressed, more involved. The sooner we become less impressed with our life, our accomplishments, our career, our relationships, the prospects in front of us, the sooner we become less impressed and more involved with these things, the sooner we get better at them. We must be more than happy to just be here. All the mortal things I had been revering in my life, everything that I was looking up to in awe, suddenly came down to eye level in front of me. All the mortal things that I had looked down upon and patronized in my life suddenly rose up to eye level. Now the world was flat, and I was looking it in the eye. It was time to trade in any red sports cars I still had. It was time to stop dreaming and start dealing. It was time for me to take care of Mom. It was time for me to take care of myself. It was time to sober up from boyhood whimsy. It was time for me to get real courage. It was time for me to become a man.
Prescription/poem, here we go. Man enough. Man enough, man enough to admit I'm scared. Man enough to know it, just man enough. Man enough to man up, man enough to be a man enough to be me, just man enough. Man enough to feel love, man enough to know love, man enough to love, just man enough. Man enough to want to be there, man enough to be on my way, man enough to be in a traffic jam and know I need a road trip, just man enough. Man enough to be drunk and sober. Man enough to be sober and drunk. Man enough to get out of the trance and enter the dream. Just man enough. Man enough to lead. Man enough to follow. Man enough to lie beside. Man enough to sleep alone. Just man enough. Man enough to die for life. Man enough to live for death. Just man enough. Man enough to have heroes. Man enough to become my own. Just man enough. Man enough not to know. Man enough to find out. Just man enough. Man enough to apologize. Man enough to realize. Just man enough.
Although the production team told me to take all the time I needed, my family insisted I go back to Austin and finish the job I'd started. 4 days after the wake, I drove back and was on the set that night. We were shooting one of the final scenes of the film on the football field that evening. Again, I had no lines in the scene, but Linklater wanted me in it. Walking around the stadium at sunset before the night's filming started, Rick and I were talking about life, loss, and what it's all about. "I think it's about living, man," I said. "Even though my dad's no longer physically here, his spirit is still alive in me for as long as I keep it alive. I mean, I can still talk to him, do my best to live by what he taught me, and keep him alive forever." I immortalized this idea that very night in a scene where Randall Pink Floyd is deciding whether or not to sign the no-drug pledge to stay on the football team. "You got to do what Randall Pink Floyd wants to do, man. And let me tell you this, the older you do get, the more rules they're going to try to get you to follow. You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N. Just keep living. Lowercase, because life is nobody's proper noun, and there ain't no G on the end of living, because life is a verb. The 3 weeks I played Wooderson in Dazed and Confused were difficult because of my loss, but graceful because of my gain. The prior year, my dad had given me approval to do what I wanted to do, but was never able to see me do it. But he was alive to see me start what I would finish, a hobby that became a career. I felt a certain serendipity in the fact that the end of my dad's life had overlapped with a new beginning in mine, on screen and off. The 3 weeks of practical experience on the set of Dazed and Confused made me a much more competent director when I returned to film school as a senior that fall. I directed a documentary about the Hispanic lowrider culture in the South called Chicano Chariots that I was proud of. Same year, I acted in What I Could, starring in an Unsolved Mysteries episode and another music video. I was ready to graduate and take I Would If I Could to I Can and I Am.
Note to self. If you're not a starter and you think you should be, give them no choice in the decision. Play so well, it's undeniable.
My plan was to drive out to Hollywood the day after graduation and sleep on Don Phillips' couch until I could get paying work as an actor or in a film production. The production manager on Dazed, Alma Cutruff, had me penciled in to work as a production assistant on the set of the next Coen Brothers film, The Hudsucker Proxy, which was scheduled to commence filming in a few months. But first, I booked a one-day gig in a local Austin film production, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation. The role was that of a Romeo to Renee Zellweger's Juliet, a motorcycle man in black leather and shades who mysteriously rides past her school at the beginning of the film, then returns at the end after she survived a night from hell to pick her up and ride her off into the sunset. I don't think I had any lines. A couple of days before the Saturday shoot, I met with the director, Kim Hinkle, who asked if I knew any male actors who might be right for the lead role of Vilmer, the killer with a mechanical leg who drives a tow truck. I gave him the names of two actors I knew from the Donna Adams Talent Agency. With a U-Haul already packed to the ceiling and hitched to the back of the four-cylinder Dodge pickup truck I'd named Surf Longview, I swung by the small home that was the production office to pick up the two scenes I'd be shooting that weekend. Come Monday, it would be time to head west, young man, and chase down my Hollywood dreams. With the two scenes in hand, I exited the house and walked up the small asphalt footpath that led through the unmowed St. Augustine yard to the curb where I'd parked. As I unlocked my driver's side door, opened it, and began to step into the cab, a thought occurred to me. Why don't I try out for the role of Vilmer? I stepped out of the open door, shut it behind me, and strode back down the walkway to the office door and without knocking, went inside.
Hey, Matthew, you forget something? Kim asked.
Yeah, I did. I want to try out for the role of Vilmer. Clearly surprised, Kim said, well, sure, that's a great idea. When do you want to try it? Right now, I said without thinking.
Well, we don't have any actresses here. It's just you, me, and Michelle, he said.
I looked at Michelle, the secretary behind the desk.
I'll do it, she said.
You mind if I try and scare the shit out of you, I asked.
No, that's fine. Go for it, she gamely said.
I ran off to the kitchen and grabbed an oversized metal kitchen spoon, stalked back into the room as Vilmer, and with a mechanical leg limp, I skidded Michelle's desk out of my way, pinned her in the corner, and proceeded to make her cry in fear.
Huh, wow. You got the part if you want it, Kim said.
Yeah, that was great. It was really scary, Michelle agreed.
I'd taken a chance and I'd gotten the part. Shooting would last 4 weeks. With all I owned already packed in the U-Haul and a terminated lease on the apartment I'd been living in, I called a buddy who had a spare couch. My trip west was going to have to wait another month because I had my second role in a movie. I was going to play Vilmer, a tow truck driving killer with a mechanical leg and a missing remote to control it.
Note to self, the genie's in the steam. People wonder how to make it in life. First of kin with innate ability and a lot of hard work, yes. But don't forget the steam, the undefined asterisk and intangible. Some call it juice, some call it magic. The genie's in the magic's in the steam.
4 weeks and 4,000 bucks later, Surf Longview, a loaded U-Haul, and I hit the I-10 freeway for the 24-hour drive to Hollywood. My adrenaline pumping for arrival, I'd been driving for just over 20 hours straight when I got to Indio, California. That's when I saw a sign for an exit that read Sunset Drive. Drive? Lane? Boulevard? Shit, who cares? That has to be the exit for the one and only legendary Sunset Boulevard. It was 8 p.m. Damn, I'm making good time, I thought as I hit the gas. Back in Austin, I'd made plans to play the CD that was now perched on my passenger seat, The Doors' L.A. Woman, upon my inaugural entrance into Hollywood. I put it in and cranked up the volume. Ray Manzarek's keyboard and Jerry Scheff's bass line began setting my stage. I turned it up louder, the soundtrack of my one and only introduction to Hollywood, California, pumping through my speakers and veins. Well, Sunset Drive is not Sunset Boulevard. As a matter of fact, Sunset Drive off the I-10 West is about 162 miles from Sunset Boulevard off the same freeway. Not knowing this at the time, I listened to the song L.A. Woman 22 times in a row, thinking the lights of Hollywood were just over the next hill. At 10:36 p.m., I arrived at Don Phillips' house on the beach in Malibu. I rang the bell. Nothing. I rang it again.
Yeah, who is it?
Don finally said from the other side of the door.
It's me, McConaughey,
I yelled.
Oh yeah, McConaughey, listen, you think you can come back later? I got this little chippy in the back.
Exhausted from the 24-hour drive and the overexertion from the premature anticipation of Sunset Boulevard, I barked,
fuck no, I can't come back later. I told you I'd be getting here tonight. I just drove from Austin, Texas.
Don opened the door, buck naked with a boner.
Yeah, you're right. Give me 20 minutes.
Then he shut the door on me. Welcome to Hollywood. Green light. Life was good at Don's and the couch was comfortable. Every night he cooked us a filet mignon, followed up with one scoop of vanilla Haagen-Dazs ice cream topped with strawberry marmalade that he always announced in his best French accent as the pièce de résistance. And there was always a fresh bottle of Stolichnaya chilling in the freezer. Still, I needed a job. I was notified that production on the Hudsucker Proxy had been moved to an unidentified date later in the year, so that PA job I was relying on was no more. I was getting anxious, ready to go to work, land an agent, read a script, audition for something, or if I had to, get another PA job. Neither was happening, and Don was the only guy I knew in town. One night over at Tenderloin, I casually said, "Hey, Don, you think you can get me a meeting with an agent, man? I only got a few grand in my name, and I need to get some work." Don snapped.
"You shut that fucking talk up right now. This town smells needy. You are done for. Before you even get started, you hear me? You need to be cool. You need to get the fuck out of here. Get out of town. Go to Europe, anywhere. And don't you come back until you're ready to not need it. And we'll talk about an agency meeting. You hear me?"
He meant it. I knew he meant it. And I knew what he meant. He didn't have to tell me twice.
Note to self. Hollywood.
Want her, don't need her. Do this and you have a chance. Don't, you won't. Forever for rent, never to own. The one we all lust for, the constant unknown. The unattainable white buffalo that dares divinity with every moonlit tryst. Does she even exist? The answer is what we need. The question's what we want. Want her, don't need her. And she might just give it up.
Kohlhauser, Rory Cochran, and I had become friends on Days Confused, and with some of my newly legislated spare time, we got together and decided we'd go to Europe for a month, rent motorcycles, and ride. We rounded up our backpacks and some petty cash, bought round-trip tickets to and from Amsterdam, then headed overseas. After landing, we rented a car and headed south, where we found a first-class motorcycle shop in Rosenheim, Germany. Wearing sleeveless shirts and dirty jeans, we shared our plans to bike across Europe with the shop's owner, Johan. "Let's find the best motorcycles for your adventure," he said.
Cole chose a big bull of a bike, a Kawasaki 1000. Rory, a Ducati Monster M900. Me, a BMW 450 Enduro. All brand new, never ridden before bikes. Perfect. Johan tallied the bill. Over $12,000. We don't have the money to rent these for a month, I said.
Well, how much do you have?
He asked. Enough to rent them for 3 days, Rory answered. Johan took a deep breath and a long look at us. His hairy, armpitted wife stood in the background, not happy with his breath or his look.
When I was a young man your age, I toured Europe on a motorbike with my friends. I opened this shop so people like you could explore the same way I did. You need to take these bikes. You need to ride these bikes, Johan said with certainty.
But we don't have enough money. All we can offer you is $400 apiece.
Do not trust them, his hairy, armpitted wife said. They may never bring them back if you do.
Yes, we will. You can have our economy class airline tickets back to America as security if you need it, I said. His wife knew where this transaction was heading and didn't like it. She violently shook her head no.
$400 apiece is $1,200 total. Pay me that and go have fun for a month on the motorbikes, he said. I don't want your return tickets for insurance. Go, ride, explore, have an adventure. I want to hear the stories when you return.
We couldn't believe our luck. We smiled at each other as Johan gave each of us a friendly bear hug, saying, have fun. We began to roll our brand new motorcycles from the showroom floor.
Not so fast, the hairpit interrupted. I'll take those plane tickets.
We handed them over, then rode out of that parking lot, leaving a proud and serene Johan in the rearview mirror, his wife scolding obscenities in his ear as he watched us ride away. We crossed Germany, Austria, the Swiss Alps, Italy. It was a geographic splendor, and what a way to see it. About 11 days into our ride, we were approaching the seaside town of Sestrilevante, Italy, when Rory laid the Ducati down, doing 120, getting off the Autobahn exit. Somehow, he came out of it with only minor cuts, bruises, a night in the hospital, and some mangled leather pants. But the brand-new Ducati Monster M900 was totaled. Rory called Johan the next day with the bad news.
I wrecked the Ducati, Johan. I totaled the bike.
Wait, Rory, you wrecked? Johan asked. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay, but the bike, it's totaled. I'm sorry, man. I don't care about the bike as long as you're okay.
I'm fine, Rory replied.
Oh, good. Where is the bike?
It's in a field just off exit 74 into Sestrilevante.
Okay. I'll send the truck and driver to you now. He should be there by tomorrow afternoon to pick up the totaled bike. Meet him there. I'm happy you're okay.
The next day, around 3 p.m., the three of us were waiting in the field next to the mangled monster when a large cargo truck showed up. Johan was behind the wheel. He greeted us warmly, eyed the totaled Ducati, then opened the back of his truck. As Rory, Cole, and I moved to load the wrecked cycle into the truck, Johan unloaded something else from it. Another brand new Ducati Monster M900. I'm glad you're okay, he said. Keep riding. So we did. Thousands of miles and 3 weeks later, we returned to Johan's shop in Rosenheim on our bikes. No longer brand new, but none of them totaled. Johan greeted us in the parking lot with bear hugs on arrival.
Oh, come inside for a coffee and tell me all about your adventures, he said with a smile.
It was epic, I said. We raced the Autobahns, drank from the Austrian rivers, traversed the Swiss Alps, had dinners in Mussolini's hideout, and raved in Rimini till sunrise. Thank you, Johan. It was the best trip we've ever taken, Cole said. After a couple of hours of tale-telling, our rental car was delivered, and it was time to head back to Amsterdam so we could fly home the next day. Johan's wife grudgingly handed us back our plane tickets home. Johan and Rosenheim. What a mensch. I hadn't thought about getting an agent or a job the entire month. I headed back to Malibu with lifelong friends and more great stories to tell. Green lights.
Prescribe prescription time. Dirt roads and autobahns. The road less traveled may not be a dirt road. For some, it may be an autobahn. Robert Frost was right.
Taking the road less traveled can make all the difference, but that road isn't necessarily the road with the least traffic. It may be the road that we, personally, have traveled less. The introvert may need to get out of the house, engage with the world, get public. The extrovert may need to stay home and read a book. Sometimes we need to get out there. Sometimes we need to get in there. Some days our road less traveled is a solitary dirt trail. On others, it's the subway on the 7 Line.
Part 4, The Art of Running Downhill. January 1994. Don loved that I had gone on the motorcycle trip through Europe with his boys. The three of us all cast by him and dazed and confused. Back sleeping on his couch, I didn't say a word about meeting an agent. Didn't even think about it. Didn't need to. One night, over another scoop of vanilla Häagen-Dazs and some strawberry marmalade, Don said, "You're ready. Tomorrow morning, I got us a meeting with Brian Swarstrom and Beth Holden at the only agency that would see us, the William Morris Talent Agency. Tell them you want to direct as well. You'll sound even less needy. They'll salivate." My resume was my performance as Wooderson in Dazed and Confused, which had been released in limited theaters a few months earlier. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, hadn't been released yet. Boots, jeans, and a tucked-in button-down, I shook their hands and sat down for my next job interview. I acted like I wanted them, not like I needed them. Swordstrom nibbled, Holden bit. I signed with Beth Holden and the William Morris Agency the next day. Now, this is usually the point in the story where the protagonist, the young wannabe actor gone west, grovels and lines up hundreds of almost got it auditions, has to take a job waiting tables, and gets asked to suck somebody's dick for a cameo role. Well, that is not my story. One week after signing with William Morris, I got my first audition in Hollywood with a casting director named Hank McCann for the role of Drew Barrymore's very honest husband, Abe Lincoln, in the film Boys on the Side. They liked my audition enough to schedule a second one for director Herb Ross 6 weeks later. A week after that first audition, I got called in for another one, this time for a Disney film called Angels in the Outfield. The role was that of an All-American baseball player named Ben Williams. I wore my American flag baseball cap and a white t-shirt for this job interview. Warner Brothers lot, bungalow 22, parking lot level. I opened the door to enter, backlit by the afternoon sun.